Good afternoon. I will call the meeting of the Environment and Natural Resources Finance and Policy Committee meeting to order, and we do have a quorum. First item on the agenda is approval of the minutes. Chair Heintzman, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Chair Fisher, and I would move the minutes.
Chair Heintzman moves the approval of the minutes from March 26, 2026. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. The minutes are approved. First item on the agenda today is House File 4740 with Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I would. I would move House File 4740 to be before the committee.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. We have the bill, House File 4740, before the committee. Representative Hansen, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. House File 4740, a version of which was introduced in a previous legislature, relates to financial assurance for feedlots and for large feedlots specifically. It would require owners of feedlot with a capacity of at least 1,000 animal units. So that is not the small feedlots, that's over 1,000 animal units, to submit proof of financial assurance of the estimated cost to implement feedlot closure requirements. Members, throughout this legislature, year after year, we hear about speeding up permitting, but very rarely do we hear about closure or disposal. Rarely do we talk about what do we do when something ends. We always want to talk about speed to get something beginning. And what this bill does is provides an assurance so that the owners will have the responsibility to take care of the cleanup once the feedlot ends. It requires the PCA to do an assessment of how many abandoned feedlots there are. It provides money from the general fund and from the environmental fund to conduct some of this work and also provide work to the county feedlot officers who in delegated counties do some of this work. Members, the world is not Green Acres and Old MacDonald anymore. You have a variety of ownership systems out there with livestock production. You may have an entity who owns the land and a different entity who may own the buildings and another entity who owns the livestock. Life happens. Things have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And when a feedlot ends, often the request to clean up comes to the public. And as a state, we have provided money, public money, to help with that cleanup. I want to use just one example here that's a larger example, that in October of 2024, we had a chicken facility, Pure Prairie Poultry Farms, I believe was the entity. And they had one point, they went bankrupt. Pure Prairie Poultry filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy in October of 2024, leaving 1.3 million broiler chickens across 14 Iowa farms and more across Minnesota and Wisconsin. That particular entity had received a loan for $45.6 million from the federal government. If you remember this, there was a scramble to try to find a home for those chickens and those eggs and to properly dispose of them. That's just one example in the poultry world. If you look on the Bowser website, there are several cases where we are taking great pride in using public money to clean up events, to build feedlot facilities, and to also deal with storage. I believe there was one county in northwestern Minnesota that had nearly 60 abandoned feedlots, if I remember correctly. My numbers might be off a little bit on that, but that was an inventory done at the local level. When we brought this bill in front of this committee 2 years ago, we were told that there was no problem, that the price of manure, the value of the manure was so great that there would not be a problem. There's still a problem because ownership may change. You may have heirs that are dealing with the property. You may have, again, diffuse ownership, differences of ownership, but you still have the manure or the feedlot facility left. If you're lucky, you don't have the livestock left if something terrible happens, whether it's an act of God or a weather emergency, etc. So I think we can dispense with the argument of 2 years ago of this is not a problem. Since that time, we've spent a lot of public money fixing this problem. and there's more on the horizon. By requiring financial responsibility for the owners of a business, which is production of livestock, then they could, we can assure that Minnesota's water would be protected and the public taxpayers would be protected as well. So I'd ask for your support. I understand there are some testifiers.
Okay, thank you, Chair Hansen. We do have several testifiers here. The first person we have is Ariel Kagan. If you'd like to come forward, please. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for taking the time to be here. If you'd like to please introduce yourself, who you're with, and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ariel Kagan, and I'm the Director of Climate and Working Lands for Minnesota Farmers Union. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill. We join with our colleagues who you'll hear from as well in sharing concerns with this bill, HF 4740. The state's NPDES and SDS permits already have closure requirements, and these additional requirements would create a burden, particularly for mid-sized farms, and would not necessarily improve the environmental outcomes. We're currently experiencing a difficult time in the farm economy. In the past year, we've lost over 1,300 farms in the state. We've also seen a surge of farmer lender mediation cases just in these early months of 2026. Adding additional carrying fees to farmers to retain financial assurances for the duration of the permit makes it harder for family farms to maintain their businesses, and especially beginning farmers looking to raise livestock. Thank you to the committee for hearing our concerns in consideration of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Lucas Sodstrom. If you'd like to come forward, please. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. Please introduce yourself, who you're with, and begin your testimony, please.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and members. Lucas Sodstrom, Executive Director of the Minnesota Milk Producers Association, also a dairy farmer in Western Stearns County. And farmers of all sizes continue to reach out to me with a consistent message. They're worried that intentions behind stopping large farms will ultimately stop them from ever reaching a sustainable scale. It takes immense grit, capital, and risk to grow a dairy operation today. Dairies of all sizes depend on the same infrastructure, the same veterinarians, equipment dealers, and most importantly, the same creameries. If we lose the scale provided by modern operations, the newer operations, our smaller farms lose the processing capacity and local infrastructure they need to survive. We believe the standards to which today's livestock facilities are constructed are already among the highest in the country. Adding more layers of review and financing and bonding only serves to deter agricultural expansion. I urge you to vote against this bill, and I thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Maddie Hokinson. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for taking the time to be here. Please introduce yourself, who you're with, and begin your testimony.
Thanks for having me here today.
Welcome.
Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify. My name is Maddie Hokinson, and I farm with my family near Goodhue, Minnesota, where we raise pigs, beef cattle, and crops on our farm, where we've been farming on the same land since 1886. I'm also a board member of the Minnesota Pork Producers Association, an organization representing Minnesota's over 3,000 family farms. We are concerned about House File 4740 and its impact on livestock farmers like myself. The Minnesota Pork Producers Association believes the additional requirements for financial assurance on feedlot permits over 1,000 animal units creates an additional unnecessary barrier for new and beginning farmers, as well as for those looking to grow and expand their farms to further diversify and create opportunities for the next generation. As a young farmer myself, our family is in the process of that transition from one generation to the next with my parents, grandparents, as well as my brother and myself. We would have to look to grow on separate sites rather than continuing to grow where we're at today because of regulation like this. But like I said, we're seventh generation pig farmers. We want to raise pigs here in Minnesota. This is home. This is where my husband and I want to raise our two boys. This is where we want to grow and expand our farm, the same as where our communities support us and we support them. But this bill pushes Minnesota in the wrong direction. These financial assurances require, they would further increase the uncompetitive nature of Minnesota in raising livestock and specifically hogs in the state of Minnesota. We have a strong track record as pig farmers in Minnesota of properly managing our barns and our manure. We know that by being good stewards and operating within our permits, we preserve the value of our farm assets. And this creates an opportunity for someone else to then down the road purchase the barns and allows flexibility for them to convert the barns to serve another purpose if a farmer does choose to exit or experiences a financial hardship. With that said, true abandonment is an extremely unlikely outcome. As a conservative estimate for a 1,000 animal unit pig barn, compliance with this bill would cost family farms $3,750 per year per permitted site to carry a line of credit with a bank to draw on, for the state to draw on. And for larger, more modern farms, that number is closer to $12,000 to $14,000. This adds significant cost at a time when farmers are experiencing financial hardship and uncertainty. This cost is borne completely by the farmer and is paid to a lender, providing no benefit to the farmer, to their business, or to the state. And according to the MPCA, there are currently no abandoned feedlots over 1,000 animal units, which would indicate that there is not a need for a bill such as this. Because of current permitting requirements for feedlots over 1,000 animal units, there are annual reporting requirements that enable the MPCA to stay informed of the potential abandonment of these feedlots, and there's already guidance in place if a closure were to have to occur. All of these safeguards already exist. And as pig farmers, we're committed to responsibly operating within our permits and doing what's right for our animals, for our communities, and for the environment. Our goal is to raise healthy animals and provide a quality, nutritious protein source for hungry people in a way that also supports our families and our communities. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you for allowing me to testify here today in opposition to House File 4740.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Bob Schiffelbein. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for taking the time to be here today.
Thanks, Chairman and Committee.
You're welcome. Please introduce yourself, who you're with, and begin your testimony.
My name is Bob Schiefelbein. I am with Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation. It's a large organization of over 30,000 members of farmers and ranchers. First, I want to thank you for hearing me. I know as someone that brings a bill, the last thing you want to do is hear people complain about why you're bringing it, and I really appreciate you at least listening to my concerns. The second thing is I come from a family farm. We're in central Minnesota. I work with 8 brothers and 6 nephews. Family farms today are not small anymore. 1,000 animal units comes very quick if you have a son and a father. It comes very quick. This might hit them. It will hurt the family farm. The other thing is the large farms, all their model is on dollars. So they want to make dollars bigger. So they're going to use the manure real wisely. MPCA already has rules that if you're over 1,000 animal units, you have to get a permit, you have an engineer to help you with the building of the facilities, manure storage. You have to do a manure plan to tell everybody or the MPCA where all your manure is going. It cannot exceed the amount of nitrogen that the plant takes on the acres, and it can't exceed the amount of phosphorus that the soil can absorb on the ground. So they have us covered, and at the end of the year, we have to give an annual report saying where we put it. The two things that I'm most worried about is when you make a rule for a whole state, especially the size of Minnesota from south to north, it gets ineffective inefficiency, since the things they do in the south are not the same as in the north. That's not a big thing, but as in general rule, making one rule for the whole state hurts individuals. The other thing, and most important thing, is the cost to Minnesota producers. Our competition isn't our neighbors anymore, it's our neighboring states. South Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, North Dakota, those who are competing against. If we have this extra money on ours, they'll become more efficient, they'll become more profitable, it'll take animal units from Minnesota and take them out. And I can guarantee, even the author of the bill didn't do this thinking I want to get rid of animal husbandry in Minnesota or the committee. So that is the biggest thing. It's going to take animal units out of Minnesota into other states, and animal industry in Minnesota is big dollars for out of state Minnesota. I don't know about the cities, but out of state, animal is huge. It's probably bigger than crops. The last thing I'd like to say is my friends at the American Turkey Growers couldn't be here. They wanted me to let you know that they oppose it. They sent letters in your packets. If there aren't any questions, I'd like to thank you for hearing me today.
You're welcome. Thank you for taking the time to be here today and for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to speak to House File 4740 today? Not seeing anyone with that. Member questions, member discussion. Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. PCA has been mentioned a couple of times. I'd be interested in hearing from them directly, if it's okay, Mr. Chair.
That'd be fine. We'll have somebody from the MPCA come up. Welcome to the committee. If you'd like to introduce yourself, and we'll be ready for the question from Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Wanted to make sure that we had a chance for PCA to make some comments on the record, and so that's all I had, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Go ahead and introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, Tom Johnson, Director of Government Relations and External Affairs for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Overall, I think that the agency does have some concerns with House File 4740. We'd be happy to provide additional technical assistance if the bill moves forward. Overall, I'd say there are unused feedlot storage units, but we would not consider those necessarily abandoned. So I know there's a definition in the law here in Section 2 that looks at a permanent, that creates a definition that essentially, if it's a closed storage area that also is then not in compliance with the closure requirements, we don't have any record of any of those situations where those storage areas are not in compliance with the closure requirements, to my knowledge. I do want to thank Representative Hansen for adding in some appropriations, but I do not think there's been a formal fiscal note on this bill, and so can't speak to the accuracy of, or if this would cover our costs. I believe there was a fiscal note in previous sessions that was larger than the amount here, and in a number of staff that would be ongoing needs, and I think some of these appropriations, just glancing, are one time and some may be ongoing, but we'd want to make sure that the staffing requirements are covered. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Hunt, okay. Okay, next I have Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. Representative Hansen, so in my county, Winona County, we have an animal unit cap. And although this is not an animal unit cap, it effectively can act like one because farmers will, in order to avoid this new regulation at 1,000, will start dividing their herds into different locations, find other feedlots. And so with that comes, now you've got to move feed across the road, which beats up the road. Now you've got to move cattle from one place to another, which beats up the road, and especially manure, which, I mean, would probably go through tankers, which again, more taxpayer burden because of the fractured infrastructure. Another problem that we ran into was feedlot officers are much more able to manage manure on a larger operation. They can control that much better. They can tell where the manure is going. It was a complexity that we, you know, kind of didn't expect at the time. And the last thing I would mention is that it could cause people to move their cattle to a different state, dairy cattle, consuming alfalfa, putting alfalfa in the environment, filters the water, better for the environment. I don't see any upside to this. And lastly, I would think that the individual private market would largely handle things. If you close a feedlot and there's manure there, that would either be an asset or a liability, which would really dictate how much the buyer would want to pay for it. So I just don't see where there's a law needed to manage something that the private sector would end up managing anyhow. I don't think I really had a question in there.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Jacob. I think those are all good points, and I think the issue is that the private market, if the private market was going to take care of it, we wouldn't be spending public dollars to clean up these events. We wouldn't have these programs where we have to deal with those abandoned feedlots, which aren't defined in statute. And I would just say, you know, to Representative Heinzman and members of the committee, if anything we could do would be to pass a definition of abandoned feedlot storage units so we have it in statute. I would think that that would be something important for the future, so we are all clear on what we're all talking about. And I'm open to discussion on that, because I think we need that, because there can be closure, there can be change of ownership, there could be change of the animals, there could be bankruptcy. Maybe it's the bankruptcy of the company, but not the farmer who owns the land. You may have someone who owns the land who heirs take over, and they may be 6 to 10 of them. I mean, you're familiar with these challenges that are out there, Representative Jacob, and I think having some definitions are important. I think the question about money, if the public continues to come back and have to take care of this, I would just say to the farm groups that testify, you will continue to lose support if the externalized costs for the production of the businesses are borne by the taxpayer, because the taxpayer will be asked to deal with issues, whether it's education or whether it's health care or whether it's cleaning up these events that may be happening. I also want to make sure I'm clear on the correction that this bill is written not to change any existing permit, but for new permits or renewal of the permits. So it's not saying if you're in the middle of your permit, stop right now and you have to provide the financial insurance. So you would have a rolling cleanup of these permits in terms of having the closure financial responsibility. I think it's important. We look at, and we've had this whole testimony over the last couple years of how do we protect the taxpayer dollars and how do we protect the environment. And an abandoned feedlot, abandoned storage, and I'm fully aware of the difference between liquid and dry, but I am aware of the realities of different ownership, different responsibilities for livestock, the sites, and some of the buildings. This is an issue we'll have to face sooner or later. We can keep putting money into the county feedlot officers, and we can keep putting money into the Bowser programs or other programs to pay for cleanup or storage or management. But the issue is going to be, I find it sad that everyone implies that the only way for livestock production to work in our state is to get bigger. Everyone said that that's modern and things just are going to get bigger. So if they get bigger, they become more, I would think they'd have to have more responsibility if you get bigger. Everyone said that was what the future is. I think that's sad.
Next we have Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and Representative Hansen. Just wondering, is the financial assurance, is that actual cash, or would this be a bond, or what form would you be looking at here?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think the chairs have been, like in community grants, have been trying to determine what financial assurance is as well. Some have talked about a surety bond. I think if we look at a commercial pesticide applicator license, they have insurance, a surety bond, or a statement of net assets. That would be a precedent type of thing, a statement of net assets from a bank, a surety bond, or a certificate of insurance that would provide the coverage. I think that the latter, the certificate of insurance, is hard to get for cleanup because you're going to be paying quite a bit for it.
Okay. Representative Nelson.
Yeah, thank you. And follow up to that. So thank you for that. I think that's probably still a little bit unclear on that. And then also, MPCA was here, and I was wondering if they would be able to, or he would be able to come up and give us an idea how many, is there an idea of how many of these feedlots have closed at this point, or you know, how many, you know, 1,000 animal units, feedlots, do they stay permanently closed, or, you know, kind of what is, or are they often resold, or what is, what typically happens with them?
Welcome back to the committee. Mr. Johnson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, for the record, Tom Johnson, government relations at MPCA. I don't have all those numbers, and happy to follow up with more specificity, Representative. I think what we usually see with a permitted feedlot, there are, we require notification if they're going to shut down. And then once we get that notification, we reach back out to them with the list of requirements for closure. And so that's not just for the feedlot storage piece, but it's for all of the portions of their farm. So if that were to happen for the permitted facilities that we're talking about, there's a pretty clear process here for closure of the whole thing. And then, you know, it's a little, I think there maybe is some, there's more of the, it's the, more on the counties when it's for unpermitted, for the smaller facilities. It's more the county feedlot officers that help with those pieces, in addition to MPCA staff. But for permitted, there's a, for permitted facilities with a NPDES permit, a Clean Water Act permit, those are a pretty formal process for closure.
Thank you. Representative Nelson?
Yeah, thank you for that. And I think, you know, I think that's helpful in understanding this. So what is the follow-up process when, you know, when a feedlot, you know, gives notice that they're going to be closing, and is there follow-up inspections, or what ends up happening as this is closing?
Mr. Johnson.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering if I have Assistant Commissioner Dana Vanderbosch with me. Maybe she has more specifics, but as she comes to the table, my understanding is there's sort of a checklist to go down, and then we would follow up with an inspection. But we'll also invite, if that's all right with you, Mr. Chair, Assistant Commissioner.
Welcome to the committee, Assistant Commissioner. If you'd like to introduce yourself and take a shot at answering the question.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and committee members. I'm Dana Vanderbosch. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Water Policy and Agriculture at the MPCA. And Director Johnson was pretty much right on the money. There are state rules for the, you know, abandonment procedures at animal feedlots, and farmers are required to notify us if they're going to be abandoning their farm sites, and then there are regulations that they need to follow. I think the case-by-case way that that happens probably varies. First of all, this doesn't happen very often. We don't receive many of these kinds of notifications. I think with our currently permitted facilities, we don't know of any where there's kind of abandonment kind of in process. And in preparation for this bill and the previous times it's been introduced, I think we've only been aware of a couple of incidences where abandonment has kind of been brought to the agency's attention. And so, you know, if people come forward and they tell us that they're going to abandon their site, sometimes they're aware of the state rules and they kind of know what they need to do. There's a checklist, and so sometimes there's a little bit more kind of work with them as they go throughout the abandonment process. And then there's also, you know, follow-up afterwards to make sure everything has been completed appropriately.
Thank you. Representative Nelson?
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Representative Schultz. And as a heads up, after Schultz, I have Jordan Burkle, Gottfried, and then Heidsman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hansen, I'm curious as to your research over the last several years, how many other states across America have this, these financial assurances for feedlots. I have heard from the time that we've spent here today, but also from producers across the state, including being on the AgriGrowth Ag and Food Tour last year, about the costs that Minnesota has by comparison to competing states around us. So it's not lost on me that for us, a financial assurance in this circumstance locks up assets that could be used to invest in some other way, or those costs get passed on to consumers. And You know, it doesn't matter exactly the food that we're seeking to eat, but it adds to costs. And so I'm curious what other states across the country have chosen this path with financial assurance.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Schultz, to my knowledge, none. But I think it's important in a discussion of cost to talk about externalized costs, because those externalized costs are the costs that the public is being asked to pick up, whether they're in wastewater, drinking water infrastructure, whether they are in cleaning up, providing assistance to feedlots. Some of the examples I used previously, you can again look on the Bowser page where we put money into those things. So yes, there's a cost of production, and that cost of production is cheaper when the public picks up the externalized costs that aren't being counted in that production.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Hansen, I sought to follow you as closely as I could there. I just think that this is a question, like, first off, we need to be dealing with, like, the issues that we have today. And I understand and I do appreciate your foresight to think about things for the long term, for the health of the state, future generations. That's a good thing, right? Just like the family farmers who were represented in the testimony today, right? The Scheffelbein family, if you just check their website, they're literally serving 14 different, you know, family members with their farm. It's super cool, right? So this question is really, is this needed today based upon the testimony that we've heard, including from the agency themselves, especially when it results, the bill, if passed, would result in steep cost increases?
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Representative Schultz, I think protecting your generation and the subsequent generations for water quality and future taxpayer costs helps out. I think that's part of it, is again those costs that may be borne in the future if there is failure. And I haven't used the large example, but if we use the biggest dairy feedlot, if that failed, how do we deal with that? Do they have the financial assurance to take care of that large feedlot of potentially 18,000 cows?
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, again, you know, that doesn't exist today, right? That doesn't exist at this moment. And at the same time, what you heard is that broadly across the entire state, while your circumstance, which is relatively hypothetical at this point, is one for the largest. But what you heard is from family farm producers across the whole state, where they're shouldering this additional expense today to potentially pay for a circumstance for something that hasn't yet been put into the ground.
Representative Hansen, any further comment?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I'll go back to the poultry example. I'm sure they didn't think they would fail, and they did.
Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I actually have kind of a continuum of what Representative Nelson was asking, which I was very interested in what happens currently. But we do have financial assurance models elsewhere in the state with other businesses. Can you talk, and I know you've worked on those issues as well, Representative Hansen, can you talk a little bit about what that model is and how it works in other sectors of our economy?
Representative Hansen.
Well, the best example I would use would be commercial applicators for pesticide, where they have to have, as I mentioned before, either a certificate of insurance, a surety bond, or a statement of net assets. I believe we took that same example to the commercial manure applicators when we created that license 25 years ago. So the people who are applying or doing a service for hire have to have that financial responsibility when there are accidents or when they're doing the business.
Okay. Representative Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's because if there is something that bad happens, we have that money to take care of it. So in absence of those different methods of financial assurances, people keep saying we pay. What does we mean? Does that mean who is we in this situation for who's paying for these businesses' failures?
Okay. Representative Hansen?
I think there's, Mr. Chair and Representative Jordan, I think there's a variety of examples that maybe there's that first responder cost that is borne by the property taxpayers of that local unit of government. Maybe it's the state coming back with feedlot assistance or cleanup assistance through Bowser. There's maybe the emergency response that's borne by the state as well if an incident occurred. And then federally, if it's a federal consequence, they may be responding as well, and there's a cost there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Hansen, for this. I think this is a pretty simple polluter's pay. You know, hopefully no one will pollute, so no one will hopefully have to pay for this. I think that's what we're all going for. But I think it's good that the public has assurances that their money won't be wasted should the unthinkable happen.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hansen, you mentioned Bowser a few times. I'm trying to find the exact site you're talking about, 60? Well, if you could give me, maybe you could supply that later. We don't need to go there now, but I'm wondering if you're talking about out-of-compliance feedlots and public money using to get active feedlots into compliance, or because I'm not finding abandoned feedlots on their website.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Burkle, I'll follow up with you and the whole committee get that.
That would be helpful.
Representative Burkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to your continued references to Pure Prairie and the situation there, I'm wondering what your thoughts would be. I mean, nobody in that situation thought they'd be in that situation. It's a bankruptcy. The company left those growers in a situation where they had to find a way to, unfortunately, dispose of birds and whatnot on their farm through no fault of their own, correct? That was not an expectation from a grower who had a contract with a company who went bankrupt and then had to figure out, because of a lack of processing capacity in the moment, what are we going to do with these animals? So why would you consider penalizing small farmers contracted to a large processor in this way? That's what I'm trying to figure the logic there.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Burkle, and I think, you know, you have specific knowledge in the poultry industry. You have a variety of ownership models that are there. The way the bill is written is owners of the feedlot. That may not be the owner of the turkeys or the chickens or the hogs. I think the responsibility should be with the risk. And I think using the Pure Prairie poultry model, that you are absolutely correct. That was the grower, the owner, who walked away with the bankruptcy, and the risks were borne by the people who owned the land and who had the birds. So I think you bring up a good point, and I want to make sure that the risks, that we are covering the risks appropriately, and I'm open to changing that in here so we're making sure it's the responsible entity, because as I mentioned earlier, it is not Old MacDonald having a farm anymore. It's not Green Acres. The owner-operator situation with rents, ownership of the livestock, ownership of the buildings, ownership of the land, those may be different in multiple situations, and I'm fully aware of that, and I think that's something I am open to trying to change so that we get the risk where it is appropriate.
Last one, Representative.
Yeah, I'll be quick. I'll close up. And thank you, Representative Hansen, or Chair Hansen. I think it's been made clear from MPCA and just in the sequence of this conversation that this really is a solution looking for a problem in my mind. Most of what you're talking about is handled. I think, I don't know if there's actually, and I'd bring MPCA up again, but I don't want to go into detail on that. But if there's an actual definition for a closed feedlot, I think we heard from MPCA, the process of how that's handled and what's required of a feedlot owner to clean his farm up if he's going to close things up. So I'll leave it at that, but I really do think this is a solution in search of a problem. And I think if there's more work to be done on how it's structured or what you're talking about, I'm open to talking about it. But I think what MPCA has outlined to us already is enough. I think we've already seen that they have a process for how feedlots are closed.
Thank you. Next, I'll go quickly. I think Representative Gilman had something close to this point, and then Gottfried, and then Heinzman.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for letting me just squeeze in a couple things. I just keep hearing about the fiscal responsibility of taxpayer dollars, and it's so refreshing to hear that in this committee right now, because I remember just 2 years ago, this committee went through billion, like we went through so many things taking taxpayer dollars. and putting on such stiff increases from, you know, you name it, we did it. And so I'm just concerned, we have farmers, and when you talk about we don't have old McDonald farms, I feel like that's offensive, because in my district, and probably many others that are sitting at the table, we do have that. And we did have a testifier, thank you for coming in today, that talked about generational farming back to 1886. So there are farmers, and I don't think it's our job as legislators to come in and say, it's sad if you get bigger. I mean, that means that there's something happening that's working well. And again, when we have MPCA that is going, you know, we don't like the way that this bill is sitting, I think that's something to consider. I am grateful to hear that you care about where taxpayer dollars are going, but I think then we should revisit some of the things that we've imposed on and the mandates on things that we had strong opposition to, blowing through an $18 billion surplus and raising taxes by $10 billion. It's frustrating to hear this right now, because I talk to the farmers that do the work, that get up before the sun comes up, that are, you know, trying to help figure out how they can have their farm go on to the next generation without being hit by taxes that are crazy for their families, to just carry on that way of life. It's part of their DNA, and I don't like the reference to saying that there's not these little farms, and that it's sad if somebody gets bigger or not. We have a demand. I don't know what people think we're going to eat around here. Some people choose not to eat animal meat, and that's great. But there's a lot of demand for good quality food and ways that we take care of the animals that provide that food. So I thank the farmers for coming to testify, and I am in strong opposition to this bill. So thank you.
Representative Gottfried.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Rep. Hansen, for bringing this forward. I think it's a good start to a conversation. I think throughout the course of this, you know, we've revealed some ways that it could be tweaked. There's, you know, to let the risk be where the financial assurances are made and whatnot. But I guess, you know, just to ground us in the problem that this is trying to solve, you know, nobody expects to be in the situation that we are in. And when we find the problem, when the problem is before us, when a company goes bankrupt and has to very quickly close all their lots and stuff, and then in the particular case that we have discussed quite a bit with Rep. Burkle, and you know, leave a bunch of growers then to discard a bunch of their product, their animals, that's when the problem presents itself. And that's often when we find private industry coming and asking for taxpayer dollars to clean up the mess. And that's the issue that we're, one of the issues that we're trying to solve here, is that the problems are not readily apparent to us, because nobody does expect us to be in this position. And so that's why this bill is being addressed. And I obviously know that this is not the end of the conversation. This is the beginning of the conversation. You know, not to drag the MPCA back up here, but I do actually have a couple of questions about the current closure requirements. I think I heard Ms. Hokanson refer to them as guidance, and then Ms. Kagan refer to them as requirements. And I guess I would just ask first, are they guidance or are they requirements?
Welcome back to the committee, Assistant Commissioner. If you'd like to go ahead and answer the question, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representatives. So the closure requirements are requirements that are in rule. They're in state law.
Representative Godfrey.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer. And then the quick question, you know, obviously you had previously mentioned requiring notice of when a feedlot is going to be closed. Could you just very broadly talk about the additional closure requirements that are then given to, you know, a farmer that is then closing their feedlot? And I think through the lens of what those requirements are trying to address if those things were not to happen, in basically meaning if they don't do these things, this environmental impact happens, X, Y, and Z, so on and so forth.
Assistant Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. I don't have the specific closure requirements in front of me, but, you know, to your question, I mean, I think our biggest concern would be the manure storage areas and just making sure that they're properly emptied so that there is no, you know, leaching of materials into the soils and kind of lingering that way, getting into the groundwater. I think there's also just like storage, you know, pads and areas outside those storage ponds that we just want to make sure would be all cleaned up and emptied out to prevent any kind of leaching or movement of material either into groundwater or surface waters.
Representative Godfrey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize. I will wrap up. This is my last one. I see that look in your face. So I guess just for the public record, what is associated when there is leaching of, let's say, manure as an example, into the ground, into groundwater? What are the potential health effects, environmental impacts of this? Because I also want to ground us is that if either the public doesn't pick up the tab to take care of this, or the private industry does not pick up the tab to do this, that is the actual thing that we're trying to avoid, is that environmental impact.
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I mean, the pollutants of greatest concern would be nutrients, phosphorus and nitrate. And so those would be the ones that we'd be most concerned about making their way into surface waters or groundwater.
Representative Godfrey.
Done.
Thank you. Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a few closing comments from this side of the table. Representative Hansen, this is, I think, something that is important to you. I'm not trying to take anything away from that. I will point out, however, as we're wrapping up, that it's pretty rare for a bill to come forward and have not a single group or individual come and testify in favor. I think we heard Minnesota Farmers Union against, Minnesota Milk against this, Minnesota Pork Producers against this, Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation against this. I'm glad it's being laid over. It's fine to have a conversation, but I think the public is watching, at least 12, as we usually say. I think Representative Burkle probably said it right. While there may be a example, it is somewhat a solution in search of a problem. If we were hearing of this as a widespread issue across the state, well then there's got to be, you know, some things that we need to look at more seriously. And if something changes, fine, let's revisit this. But maybe our focus should be rather on the things that we can do to help agriculture avoid the financial hardships that they often find here in Minnesota as opposed to other states. I know it sounds like maybe a clanging cymbal at this point to start to say things like that, but I'm going to try to keep it as bipartisan as I can in my comment. And we do have some great examples of that, and I think Chair Fisher and House GOP and DFL members are being very collaborative in our work on the community grants program and on a surety bond that's paid for by the ENRTF and so on. That's a great example of something we can do collaboratively. I don't think this is one of those issues today. Like I said, if something does change here in Minnesota, fine. Maybe this comes back up. But quite honestly, I don't think it is. And I think we can refocus on things that are deliberative and helpful to our family farms, large and small, in Minnesota, and we can focus on helping them in changing economic times. So I'll leave it there. And again, glad it's being laid over. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Welcome. Chair Hansen, final word.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the debate. You know, what is the difference since the last time this bill was heard? Well, you had a collapse of that poultry farm. That happened after. So it happened between then and now. There's an example. It's going to continue to happen because of the volatility. It's unfortunate Representative Gilman has left because I did want to specifically counter something. I said it was sad that all the testimony said that the only way was to get bigger. That is what I said. I've learned after 22 years of being here that broad statements are often used in arguing. I think there's an actual technique for that, but a diverse agriculture is one where people thrive. And I have also seen the old McDonald image used by very, very, very big entities in videos and production. Because it does pull at the heartstrings of all of us, because it's part of who we are as Minnesotans. So protecting our water is also there so that the processors who process the food have clean water to expand or to process. We need that. We'll be back again. These things are going to continue. I'm open to trying to change some of these things to make it work. There will be a new administration next year, and maybe it's time to look at some of these things again. Thank you. I lay the bill over.
Thank you. With that, Representative Hansen renews his motion that House File 4740 be laid over. The bill is laid over. Next on the agenda, we have Representative Vice Chair Purcell, House File 3940. Vice Chair Purcell, welcome. Would you like to move your bill?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Purcell moves House File 3940 before the committee. I see that you have a technical amendment. Would you like to explain the A1, please?
Mr. Chair, I can have our nonpartisan staff explain. It's a very simple amendment.
Okay. Ms. Taylor.
Chair and members, this is very technical. It's just replacing commissioner with board since we're talking about the EQB and they do not have a commissioner.
Okay, very good. Any questions? Seeing none, all in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Motion carries and the amendment is approved. Onto the vice chair, onto your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm proud to present House File 3940, which would require an environmental impact statement, or EIS, for livestock projects over 10,000 animal units. When I last presented this bill, some of you may remember, there was the possibility of a 21,000 animal unit project, and now here we are 2 years later with a proposed dairy operation that would expand that operation to more than 26,000 animal units. For reference, the average size dairy, according to the last ag census, was less than 400 cows. In the late 1990s, this body debated our feedlot permitting rules. At that time, a dairy of 1,000 was a large herd and therefore requires an EAW. When our predecessors heard that debate, many didn't anticipate the size of projects we'd be permitting in Minnesota today, and with minimal environmental review. I'm bringing this bill forward again because it's past time to do something about the permitting of livestock projects on this scale. This bill isn't unrelated to the large volume water users bill you heard me present earlier this session. I dare to call the scale of a dairy operation a hyperscale dairy, just like we know that hyperscale data centers are a different beast than the data centers that we have today. We know Minnesotans deserve an additional level of scrutiny and transparency around any private operation of this size, even if it's an agricultural land use, not commercial or industrial, like my previous bill. I have a deep concern for the remaining rural and farming families across our state who are in another set of farm crises today. Aging farmers, low commodity prices, tariffs, skyrocketing costs of inputs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And while they get squeezed, the single largest operator in our state continues to expand. For decades now, we've incentivized farmers to get big or get out, but let's also make sure we're protecting drinking water, runoff, and manure management on and nearby these enormous operations. Projects of this scale have the potential to have an outsized effect on our environment, and I think it's worth our time today to talk about whether they deserve an added level of review. In 2025, the state did 53 EAWs and only 3 environmental impact statements. The rolling 10-year average is 65 EAWs per year. Only 23% of the responsible government units held a public meeting for those EAWs. In the EIS process, it would be mandatory to get that local input. The EIS process also includes a pump test. Often these larger operations dig wells into deeper aquifers, but then pollute into more shallow aquifers, where neighbors and legacy farms have their private drinking water come from. Luckily, this is very pertinent to today. Just this week, NPR ran a story on a proposed expansion of West River Dairy outside Morris in Stevens County to 18,855 head of cattle, nearly the amount that the Grand Casino Arena holds. That's the equivalent excrement of about 1.1 million humans, according to data from Cornell College calculator. And that will mean an incredible need for water, an incredible amount of animal waste, not to mention potential air pollution, living conditions for employees and the animals, land application of the manure, et cetera, et cetera. The timing is right for House File 3940. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is updating its feedlot rules to better manage pollution. And the Minnesota Department of Agriculture is presently reviewing the groundwater protection rule to ensure it protects drinking water from nitrates, something that the EPA found our state lacking doing to protect water for Minnesotans in my part of the state 2 years ago. House File 3940 tells Minnesotans that the legislature is moving in sync with our pollution control regulators to help protect Minnesota's environment and the well-beings of Minnesotans. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd be glad to turn it over to testifiers.
Thank you, Vice Chair Purcell. First on the list, I have Laura Schreiber. If you'd like to come forward, please. Thank you for taking the time to be here today. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Fisher and committee members, for the opportunity to testify. My name is Laura Schreiber. I'm the Government Relations Director for the Land Stewardship Project. We're a grassroots membership-based nonprofit working to create a more sustainable and just farm and food system. On behalf of our members, I'm happy to share our strong support for Representative Purcell's bill, which would direct the Environmental Quality Board to automatically require that feedlots, whether new or existing, that are looking to expand to 10,000 animal units must undergo a mandatory environmental impact statement, or EIS. Currently, feedlots with 1,000 animal units or more must submit an environmental assessment worksheet, which, according to the MPCA, is a brief document designed to lay out a project's basic facts and assess its potential for significant environmental effects, which helps determine if an EIS is needed. Whereas an EIS differs in that it is a comprehensive review of the possible environmental, economic, employment, and sociological impacts of the proposed project. And most notably, an EIS must identify potential ways to minimize these impacts or propose alternatives to the project. It is a tool to gather information to truly understand the potential impacts of a project, considering a variety of factors. This information is especially necessary considering that Minnesota's existing 18,000 feedlots, only 6% are 1,000 animal units or more. A 10,000 animal unit feedlot or more is incredibly rare and deserves to have additional scrutiny. This type of comprehensive review would truly be for the biggest of the big operators. If we take the dairy example, as Representative Purcell has alluded to, in Minnesota, the average dairy herd size is 280 cows or 382 animal units, according to federal census data. In Minnesota, over the last 30 years, we have seen a steady decline of our dairy farms, with 9,000 dairy farms in 1995 to now we are just over 1,600 dairy farms in Minnesota. Small and medium-sized farms are being pushed out of the market due to inconsistent and often below cost of production milk prices and are being squeezed out by larger operations that can flood the market with cheaper to produce milk. Taking into account the economic impacts of a proposed feedlot of 10,000 animal units or more, when our farmers and our rural communities are already feeling the effects of consolidation on Main Street and in the viability of smaller farms, this information is truly critical to have and to inform our future decision-making. Just a few weeks ago, the DNR shared a presentation with this committee on groundwater sustainability, and notably, we don't even have all of our aquifers mapped in Minnesota, especially in western Minnesota. On average, a 10,000 animal unit dairy would use millions to potentially hundreds of millions of gallons of water per year, and especially as we are experiencing greater extreme weather and climate change, having this comprehensive review that an EIS provides is truly critical. Today, actually, Carrie Redden, who is a dairy farmer in Stevens County, wanted to speak with you, but she also, for her off-farm job, works in an accounting office, so you can assume it's a pretty busy time for her, so she was not able to step away, but she's a retired dairy farmer, and now they raise beef cattle, but if she was here, she would tell you that this bill is needed now. As Rep. Purcell shared, Carrie's in Stevens County, where West River Dairy and Morris in Stevens County is looking to expand and add 11,000 cows, which would increase their dairy herd size to 18,555 cows, or more than 26,000 animal units. An EIS is a tool to have a full scope accounting of potential impacts to our communities and the environment, economic and sociological impacts. And we need that information, especially for these biggest of the big. So thank you for the time to testify, and I really urge the committee to think about and support this bill for the information for our farmers and for future environment. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Ann Twagerl. Excuse me if I didn't get it right there. Thank you for taking that time to be here today. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, Chairs Fisher and Heinzman. See, I can do last names wrong too. For the record, my name is Ann Schwagel. I am a farmer in Big Stone County in western Minnesota. I am here on behalf of Minnesota Farmers Union in support of House File 3940. I serve as the vice president of MFU, which is a grassroots, membership-driven organization representing family farmers in rural communities across the state. Our members include family dairies, many who are struggling to stay in business while they shoulder milk prices well below their cost of production. They care deeply about both environmental stewardship and the long-term viability of rural economies. We support this legislation because it recognizes a simple reality. The scale of livestock operations in Minnesota is changing, and our review processes need to keep pace. Projects of unprecedented size, like the proposed mega dairy expansion in Stevens County, next door to me, bring potential impacts that go beyond what was envisioned when Minnesota's current livestock feedlot rules were developed decades ago. These regulations should be scaled. Large companies can afford to hire compliance staff that a family-sized operation can't. An environmental impact statement is not about stopping projects. It's about ensuring that we fully understand their environmental, economic, and social consequences before they move forward. From our members' perspectives, there are several key concerns. First, water use and water quality. Large-scale livestock operations require significant continuous water withdrawals. Farmers in the surrounding area need confidence that shared groundwater resources will remain sufficient and protected. Second is risk. As livestock is consolidated into fewer, larger facilities, the consequences of disease outbreaks, natural disasters, or system failures can become more significant, not just for the operation itself, but for neighboring farms and communities. Third is rural economic impacts. As you heard from a previous testifier, Minnesota has lost nearly half of its dairy farms in the past decade, even as the number of dairy cows has remained steady. This points to rapid consolidation that can reshape local economies in ways that deserve careful analysis. Finally, public trust. An EIS provides transparency and a meaningful opportunity for community input. When projects are this large and this different, Minnesotans expect and deserve that level of review. House File 3940 ensures that when projects exceed certain thresholds, we take a closer look before moving forward. That's a reasonable, measured approach that supports both responsible development and strong rural communities. Thank you for your time and consideration, and for Representative Purcell's leadership here.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Darren Broughton. Welcome to the committee. Thanks for taking the time to be here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon, members. Excuse me, Darren Broughton, Executive Director of Minnesota AgriGrowth. Do appreciate the opportunity to testify on this bill. Most Minnesotans have an image of a typical dairy farm. And mine is my grandparents' farm. with its 60 head of Holsteins just outside Penn Island. They farmed there for 40 plus years until they decided to sell when he retired to his neighbor and friend next door who had 400 cows. It is these memories and images that has tainted our ability to really recognize that raising livestock, and in this case dairy, has evolved since the 1980s and 90s. House File 3940 fails to recognize that evolution. Instead, it relies on those memories and feelings rather than the science and the data. Like the 1,000 animal unit threshold for feedlot permits, which was established by the legislature almost 30 years ago, the proposed 10,000 threshold for this EIS is based upon those memories and feelings and not the science. No science or evidence shows that a barn with 10,000 cows poses a greater environmental risk than a barn with 9,990. It is a made-up number by the legislature. If we looked at the science and data, we would see that larger barns and farming operations have more requirements for manure management, water use or reuse, and climate mitigation than smaller farms. A stream or river in Minnesota is substantially more likely to be polluted by a city's wastewater treatment plant that overflows during an extreme weather event than by a large feedlot. That's not my data, that is state agency data. House File 3940 also fails to recognize that the MPC already has tools in place to protect our waters. The feedlot EAW now includes information about water use and reuse, aquifers, and conservation measures, and all of that is available for public comment. The MPC also has the ability to issue an individual feedlot permit to an operator versus a general feedlot permit. The proposed West Dairy permit is an individual permit and would be the most stringent permit in the state of Minnesota. It would require the use of a 60-inch liner for liquid manure storage compared to the 24 inches in the general permit. It requires Riverview to notify the MPCA 3 days before manure is land applied. The general feedlot permit has no such requirement. From stricter water usage to manure management, the MPCA has proposed strict safeguards on our waters. And AgriGrowth will work with any legislator to codify and strengthen the MPCA's authority to issue individual feedlot permits. House File 3940 is weaponizing our state's environmental review and laws to address economic concerns. I want to remind folks that an EIS stands for an environmental impact statement, not an economic one. If the legislature is concerned about the economics of dairy and cattle farms of all sizes, then we should have a thoughtful discussion on it, and we should have a thoughtful discussion on it. But using environmental review and laws to address economics of an industry is inappropriate. Let's use the science and data, not our fading memories, to make better decisions to help Minnesota farmers. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next, I have Lucas Sostrom. Welcome back. Thank you for being here. Please introduce yourself again and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Lucas Sostrom, Executive Director of the Minnesota Milk Producers Association. Chair Fisher and members of the committee, we stand in opposition to House File 3940. First, I want to reference a few things that have come out through testimony before reading my remarks. It's been mentioned a couple times, the single largest dairy expanding. I just want to remind the committee, last time this bill or version of this bill came forward, we had multiple letters from multiple farms come forward. One thing about dairy, and this affects dairy the most, because when you do math, cows are actually bigger than the other animals affected through this, so therefore cows are more likely to be at permits this size. But dairies, if they are built in the state today, and if they are built in the state for the last 20 years, that means they have a willing buyer who knows very well their environmental, their social, their economic outlook and impact, and very likely the willing buyer of their milk is going to be someone who's familiar and used to that operation. So it shouldn't be a surprise, I think, to the committee that our well-run dairies, and I mean that in every sense of the word, are the ones that the buyers are coming to and saying, hey, why don't you do that again? Why don't you see if you can find another spot to do that? But again, I want to mention that it's one dairy has been mentioned here today that's up for permit, but multiple letters from multiple farms who would love to be at levels that would be impacted by this bill were submitted last time. Second, one of our issues, I drive 2 hours when I get to come down here and sit in front of you, and I hope many of you take the chance when you get the opportunity to drive 2 hours back and see some of our dairies. I've had the fortunate opportunity through my different professions to see animal units of this scale of several species, sheep in Colorado, cattle in Kansas, dairy cattle in Idaho and California and Arizona, all well-run operations, many times in complete deserts. Minnesota, we have soil, we have water resources, we have things that other states don't and vice versa, and we manage them extremely well. And so when we point to things like we've never had something of that size before, well, within our borders, that's correct, but I think some of the laws that were referenced and some of the requirements referenced before may be big reason for that. If you can do this in a desert, you can very well do it in soil that can capture the nutrients and grow a crop on it. As you all know, this bill mandates environmental impact statements for all animal feedlots over 10,000 animal units. While this may be framed as a targeted measure, we have seen this regulatory approach fail in very different ways for one of our neighbors. In North Dakota, they used to have rigid restrictions on how family members could farm together. Second cousins could not partner up in livestock operations. And that was intended to protect the family farm. This has resulted, at least in part, to them having 17 dairies left in North Dakota. The infrastructure there is gone, and they are excited to see new dairies coming back into North Dakota. And I can say that of some of my friends of all sizes of dairies. The transition from an EAW, an environmental assessment worksheet, to a mandatory EIS is a major disruption to the current regulatory framework. EAWs are already required for over 1,000 animal units. Moving to a mandatory EIS adds layers and layers of review that negatively impact project timelines and costs without necessarily providing additional environmental protection. One other thing referenced here was that farms of this size will pollute into shallow aquifers. I take strong issue with that. First of all, over 1,000 animal units, it is the non-pollutant discharge elimination system. That means pollution is not allowed, and they need to know where the water is coming in and where it is going out. And so I think to say that they're polluting into shallow aquifers nearby would be a misstatement slightly. Every dairy cow in production, back to the economics, represents 25,495 in annual economic impact. We have a regional demand for 250,000 cows. That is processing plants that are being built now are going to be demanding 250,000 cows. And if we wanted to, every single one of them could be built in Minnesota or could be added in Minnesota. If we make the environmental review process insurmountable, that growth and the $1.4 billion in economic activity that comes with it will move west to the I-29 corridor in neighboring states. We urge you to let farmers figure out the best way to grow their operations rather than eliminating dairy growth through legislative mandates. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Finally, I have Hunter Pedersen. Welcome to the committee. Thank you for taking the time to be here. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. For the record, my name is Hunter Pedersen, and I serve as the Public Policy Specialist at Minnesota Farm Bureau Federation. We are a general farm organization with 30,000 family farm and ranch members across the state of Minnesota. And I appreciate the opportunity to be here today to testify in opposition to House File 3940, legislation that would require an environmental impact statement for livestock projects over 10,000 animal units. As evidenced by the consistent reporting they already do within current regulatory frameworks, farmers and ranchers of every size and shape take their role as environmental stewards seriously. The existing environmental review framework, in our view, already addresses the environmental concerns that come with larger farms. Currently, the commissioner of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency can already determine whether a formal environmental impact statement is necessary after reviewing the submitted environmental assessment worksheet, EAW. All farms that wish to expand over 1,000 animal units are required to fill out that EAW. And setting a mandatory environmental impact statement precedent for specific farm sizes would deter the future growth of family farms, which often look to expansion as a way to keep the next generations on the farm and in agriculture. We certainly recognize the concerns that come with larger farms in regard to the environment, and we believe in the value of competition in the marketplace. The economic impact and growth, the economic impact of the growth and opportunity that these farms bring to their local communities cannot be understated. The addition of another assessment to an already robust regulatory framework can be hurtful not just to the farms that could possibly expand to this size proposed in the bill, but also to the smaller operations around them. Thank you for the opportunity to voice our concerns about this legislation, and I would ask the committee to oppose the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience that would like to testify to this bill? Seeing none, I will move on to member comments. Chair Heintzman has got some questions for the MPCA. If they'd like to come forward, please. Chair Heintzman, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do. First of all, I'd just like to know where MPCA is on this, if there's an official position or just a thought that you'd like to share in terms of what we've heard today. And then also, if we could possibly get a ballpark idea of how the process looks under current statute, that would probably be helpful for the committee. My understanding is the process that's being asked for in this language could be triggered by those within the county affected and adjoining counties. I think 100 signatures might be the threshold, if I remember correctly. So if those things could be covered, that'd be great. Thank you.
Assistant Commissioner Vanderbush, go ahead and introduce yourself again and then begin your testimony to the answering the questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. And again, for the record, I'm Dana Vanderbosch, Assistant Commissioner for Water Policy and Ag at the MPCA. Thank you for the questions. The MPCA doesn't really have a formal position on this bill. You know, we recognize that the legislature can create these new categories for environmental review, and we don't necessarily have a concern or a position on that. I will say the exact number that you would use as the trigger for a new threshold requiring an EIS is difficult to determine, and we don't have a recommendation that would be based on any kind of data. So I think that would be the answer to your first question. And you ask questions that are more procedural, right, about completing an EAW. I'm wondering if those questions are for me or for the executive director of EQB.
Chair Heintzman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. My recollection, in fact, this would be just last year, is that we could trigger an EIS if 100 Minnesotans that live within the county of the project or an adjoining county, they could submit a petition to the EQB. Now, that was a change that was made in a bipartisan way last year. That was my recollection. I just wanted to make sure that that was pointed out for the record today as we're discussing this bill, because I don't want people to be under the impression that there's no way for us to move from an EAW currently and not have any circumstances that would be available if an EIS was something that was determined to be necessary. So I just wanted to confirm that on the record. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Hi, welcome to the committee. If you'd like to introduce yourself and begin answering the question.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Catherine Neuschler. I'm the Executive Director of the Environmental Quality Board. So with the environmental review process, any environmental assessment worksheet, when it's completed, at the end of that process, the governmental unit, so for feedlots, the PCA, has to make a decision about whether there should be an EIS completed for the project. And that's based on sort of the type of the environmental effects, to what extent they're subject to mitigation. There's decision criteria laid out in rule. So any EAW can proceed to an EIS if that's determined to be needed based on the rule. The petition process, which, as you noted, was changed last year, allows for the public with 100 signatures in the county of the project or an adjoining county to petition for an EAW. And then that EAW, if the governmental unit determines it's warranted based on the potential for significant environmental effects, would go through the regular process, could proceed to an EIS. But there is no petition directly for an EIS.
Chair Heintzman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that testimony. I think it was important for today's discussion on the bill. So I'll hold my comments further till the end.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some questions for MPCA. Mr. Johnson.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Johnson. Representative Hansen, go ahead with your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Johnson, if a 10,000 animal unit dairy failed tonight, if a bankruptcy occurred and it failed, who would milk the cows?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, if it failed financially?
Yes, Representative financially.
Mr. Chair, I am not sure who would milk the cows.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair, if a 10,000 cow dairy failed tonight, who would move the manure?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Hansen, so if it failed tonight with absolutely no notice is what you're saying?
Yep.
I have never heard of such an occurrence, Mr. Chair. I don't have much precedent to answer your question.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Johnson, when we're looking at, and I want to get into the science, and maybe this is the other staff as well, when you're looking at the application of manure, is it based on N as the limiting factor or P? Is it nitrogen or phosphorus when looking at the land application rates on where the manure is applied?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, I would defer to the Assistant Commissioner.
Assistant Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hansen, it's nitrogen is the limit. The rate is based on nitrogen.
Representative Hansen.
And thank you, Mr. Chair. And when it's based on nitrogen, there are soils in Minnesota that are naturally high in phosphorus. So the capacity, the carrying capacity of the phosphorus, if you keep applying the manure, you keep adding to the phosphorus over and over and over. So essentially you get very high phosphorus rates. Is that correct?
Assistant Commissioner.
Chair, Representative Hansen, I'm not sure of the answer to that question.
Representative Hansen.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson, if we were going to create a city of a million people, we would require a wastewater system, a drinking water system. We would require treatment for wastewater. We would require the people of that city to pay property taxes and assessments on that in order to build it. Is that correct?
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is correct. I believe there's a mandatory category for EAW for some of those, not necessarily an EIS, Mr. Chair, to the issue at hand.
Thank you. Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Johnson, so if we're, let's say you're a city that's growing, a small community, a township, and you, a city annexes part of the township into their system, they would have to handle that waste, right? They would have to be, they'd be responsible, the property taxpayers would be responsible for that.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe if whatever the rate payers who cover the total cost of the water treatment facility who pay into that system, yes.
Representative Hansen.
And Mr. Chair, just, you know, was in the bonding committee today, been on the tours, every small town wanting millions of dollars for wastewater, for drinking water, millions and millions. And maybe it's non-point that's actually causing the nitrates or other pollutants that are there. Again, costs that are being asked to be picked up through the Public Facilities Authority or through grants, or some of that $18 billion went to fund some of these projects. So I don't know. Again, it's kind of surprising to have the industry come here and say, get big or get out. It's the only way. And don't change that. $10,000, 10,000 animal units today is 1,000 from 30 years ago. So I guess 100,000 30 years from now is what we'll, our successors will be arguing about. Maybe that's one per state. We just have one big one per state.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Johnson.
To your point, Representative Hansen, most of the nitrate is non-point source. I think that is a fair characterization. These feedlots that are permitted and are of this size are considered point source. And it would be more different types of agricultural activities that might be considered non-point source. But I think you're accurate on that piece.
Representative Schultz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I found it interesting and honestly probably a little bit challenging to ask the person who works in an office in St. Paul what would happen in the case of a unfortunate bankruptcy or failure. So I wanted to ask if a farmer could answer this question. So I wanted to ask if Mr. Solsham was available as a dairy producer.
Mr. Solsham, welcome back to the committee. Representative Schultz, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Solsham. If a large dairy of some size were to fail overnight, what would happen and who would milk the cows?
Mr. Solsham.
Mr. Chair and members, while unfortunate and, of course, something I think none of us would want, this has happened in other states. Typically, they're very integrated with their lenders, and typically it's not an overnight surprise, and they deal with it. If any of you know a good auctioneer, not just an auctioneer, but a good auctioneer, they might be able to take care of it. But this is what happens. Our livestock markets are open every day, and I think I've seen and dealt with and been involved with farm failures of all size, and I don't think anything of this scale or larger wouldn't be dealt with. And I would suspect lenders and farms of this size are more likely to have the contingency plans in place to deal with something like that. But I would not expect overnight is even a possibility due to the controls that they have in place, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Schultz.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And, you know, maybe we'll be able to find that good auctioneer someday. I've heard that we have, you know, a couple hundred that are licensed here in Minnesota. But then beyond that, you know, Mr. Solsham, if this very unfortunate circumstance were to happen, would there be any risk to the public in a very short term period of time? And maybe you can outline for the committee what would happen to the manure.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Mr. Solstrom.
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Schultz. So if it's today, for example, we're gonna presume that their manure facility is either half full or near full. And if the cows are gone, you would do nothing. You'd figure out where the crops need it and when. And I would think, based on the requirements we've heard, I mean, you're going to deal with it and apply the nutrients when you need to. You know, that's the beauty of our facilities. I think they have time. They have the measures built in that whatever day of the year this happens, assuming the animals are gone, you could wait. I would say I'll let MPCA answer if they differ, but you could wait a couple years and those nutrients are going to be good. But the faster you apply it, the better it's going to be for the crops. So I think the first field nearby that would take it, obviously they were planning to use those nutrients per fields. That's why they have a nutrient management plan, would happily take them with record cattle and record fertilizer prices right now. I mean, I think this is not an issue. It's going to be an asset the bankers are the lenders are banking on already as credit. But yeah.
Okay. Representative Schultz. Representative Chair Heintzman, final comments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I don't have any further questions, Representative Purcell, so don't worry about that. But I do think that this bill coming forward, unfortunately, is very similar to the previous bill in that could make the argument that this is a solution in search of a problem. If it was a widespread issue statewide, let's revisit this. In the meantime, we are proposing yet more regulations for farms, and we have a trend of sorts where we have environmental groups pitted against agriculture. And environmental groups looking for more regulation while farmers are here pleading, begging, please don't do this. And I'm glad we're in the circumstance where we have to come together in a bipartisan way and something to go forward, and this is not going to go forward. Maybe there's a version of something that could get at the concerns being raised today, but I don't think this is the answer. And we've had a good discussion. That's a positive, but it is quite a disruption to have so many folks travel from all over the state to have to come here and make the case that this hurts their industry. I trust them. I believe that they're here advocating with all of our best interests in mind. I'm glad PCA was able to also come and testify. Again, nobody's, at least near as I could tell, from the agency indicating to us that, like I said a moment ago, this is a widespread issue that has to be addressed in this way. And Mr. Chair, I'm thankful that, again, the discussion was had and the bill will be laid over, and we'll move on from there. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Chair Heintzman. Final closing comment, Vice Chair Purcell.
Thank you, Chair Fisher. Yes, I would like to thank all of the testifiers. I know the first two testifiers were from agricultural groups in support of my bill, so I don't think that's a fair characterization to pit groups against each other. When I do think we are all concerned about water and rural quality of life. I guess I would have more assurances and maybe not feel the need to bring this bill if we still had a citizens board of our MPCA and there was an opportunity for neighbors to be able to take action. So happy to bring that bill back next year as well. I'll just play the hits here. And I agree. I think that just like Mr. Broughton said from AgriGoth, we need to use science and data, and that's what an EIS does. It doesn't determine what happens. It gets us the science and the data. And it also happens to take in economic conditions as well. But we are the Environment Committee. One thing I just want to touch on, this one producer that is the only company that has animal units in this scale as of yet, didn't do so great when they were doing the agriculture in the desert. There's an $11 million settlement that the state attorney general from Arizona had to find to Riverview Dairy because of all the neighbors, their town's aquifer and the private aquifers in the area. So I would love to be proactive before this is an even greater problem. We know this is happening now with this proposed expansion. The MPCA will be holding public meeting on Tuesday, April 28th from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Southside Event Center and Reception Hall in Morris, Minnesota, where public comment on the feedlot permit and also this proposed expansion. If you are in that county or in an adjoining county, please, this is the way you can get some more information. And I am grateful for all the time today. Thank you, Chair Fisher.
Vice Chair Purcell renews her motion that House File 3940 as amended be laid over. The bill is laid over as amended. With that, we will go to a quick presentation on the governor's proposal here. First up, we'll have John Frawley from the Minnesota Zoo. As we're getting set up, then we'll have Lisa Beth Barajas from the Metropolitan Council, followed by Colonel Rodman Smith, and then Tom Johnson. And we've got exactly 11 minutes here to flow through this. So I want to say thank you for doing abbreviated versions here. Mr. Frawley, go ahead and introduce yourself and kick us off.
Mr. Chair, committee members, John Frawley, Director of the Minnesota Zoo. Thank you so much for the time. Reminder about the Minnesota Zoo real quick. We are a state agency. We have a new economic impact reaching over $320 million. The zoo is doing quite well with over 1.5 million visitors. We're actually a nationally recognized zoo. But we're also unique in that the state funds us at this current time. About 36% of our operating budget is funded by the state. We are grateful that the governor recommended a supplemental budget for the zoo of $3.8 million. This aligns with the budget request from last session, which we did not receive the full amount to cover our critical operating needs. The zoo does have a major operational adjustment need. Our current budget is underfunded and is currently running on reserves. So this supplemental funding will get us, it'll be a one-time bridge through this biennium. But we will be looking towards the next session to make a case about a safe and better operating level. The zoo has taken aggressive action. We have been, we've cut over $4.5 million of our budget. We have over 20 plus positions that are vacated right now. We've been eliminating guest experiences. We have our pricing at the peak of what we can do to make, with still keeping the zoo accessible. And a lot of people ask us about our foundation raising money that raises capital but not operating budgets. The real drivers behind this obviously are our workforce. We're a large zoo, but we have one of the smallest workforces per zoo size in the country. So that's putting a lot of pressure, especially with all the vacancies and open positions, and the compensations and benefits to serve that group and to grow that group. We also have aging infrastructure. It's not the new zoo anymore. We're rated among one of the worst state agencies for infrastructure, with one-third of our buildings in poor or crisis conditions. Those two things together create human and safety animal risk. This is me coming forward as a director saying we're at the level that is concerning. We need to bring a better staffing. When we look at our incident rates and we look at core problems of the incidences, the root causes, it's tracking back to staffing levels, it's tracking back to facilities. And our rates are some of the highest in state agencies. On top of all of that, as you know, the zoo operates, it depends on weather. This last season, we had 32 days of rainfall, 13 days of record-breaking heat, 22 days of air quality concerns, not to go outside, and major highway construction. So those are the things that our budget has to navigate. And so I appreciate you considering this request, Mr. Chair.
Thank you so much. Appreciate your presentation. Next, we will go on to Met Council. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lisa Barajas, Executive Director of Community Development at the Metropolitan Council, and thank you for hearing us today. I have two budget neutral items that I am pleased to present on behalf of the governor. The first is an extension for tree planting grants from our 2024 funding allocation. They're both $3.1 million in our tree planting program that was newly established by the legislature, and then $1.4 million from the Natural Resources Fund for the Regional Parks and Trails System. All of this funding is already encumbered in grants with all of the affected agencies, so local units of government and implementing agencies. But given the timing and the work that we're doing, and well, trees are really dependent on the weather, as my predecessor noted. And so this additional time extension request that we are proposing would really help to ensure the success of the work that the grantees have underway and allow them to close out that work. The second budget neutral item that we're proposing is really a reassignment of an appropriation that was grant funding to the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board for the Cedar Riverside Rec Center project. It was assigned to DEED most recently in the 2024 cycle, and we are proposing to reassign that to the Met Council. So while it looks like an increase in funding for Met Council, overall it is budget neutral, just switching the assignment from DEED to the Met Council. This really helps us to streamline overall for Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board to streamline oversight of the grant funding they are receiving from the state that we're already managing at the Met Council on behalf of for this project, and put these two appropriations together into one grant. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Ms. Barajas, for your presentation. Next, I have Colonel Smith.
Hello,
Welcome to the committee, Colonel Smith. Thanks for being patient with us today. If you'd like to go ahead and begin your presentation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Colonel Rodman Smith, Director of Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources. DNR has two supplemental budget requests or proposals in the governor's supplemental budget. The first is law enforcement response costs, so conservation officers are licensed peace officers and a state resource when it comes to licensed peace officers. This year, we've had a couple of instances where there are mutual aid requests for state law enforcement resources to assist local agencies where they could not staff those incidents. Typically, those requests go to the state patrol, and then if they can't staff those, they call us to help with that staffing. So this year, we did help at the request of Minneapolis PD do some patrols around schools after the tragic Annunciation shootings for about a week. This also includes activities in January around Operation Metro Surge. And then most recently, the No Kings rally in March that just happened here at the state capitol grounds a couple weeks ago. Also includes some of the training. So these costs include officer payroll, meals, lodging, and supplies. Although this work is not typical of what we do, it is becoming more typical. In today's law enforcement, the way that staffing is across the state, we see more and more mutual aid requests coming to the state to help with those resources where they can't meet those staffing challenges alone. So we stand ready to help our partnering agencies and the people in those communities when that mutual aid is needed. And so that's the first one. The second piece of the supplemental budget is the lands bill. And really what that is revenue coming into the DNR for a couple different sales. You can see the Becker County one, there's currently assessed value is $225,000. And the second one is a Mille Lacs County sale where the preliminary proposal is $251,000. So if those sales go through, that'll be needed to be included. So and that's all I have.
Thank you, Colonel Smith.
Thank you.
Next, I have Tom Johnson for the MPCA.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, Tom Johnson, government relations for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Got a couple of items here. I'll breeze through this first one. Batteries is something the committee has heard already. Along with that, the governor does recommend also an electronic product stewardship program. The agency has been continuing to work with stakeholders on that. It's not quite as close as the battery issue. We're all open to continuing working on this piece, but there are still some items to work out. So not necessarily anticipating that this will continue this year, but these two proposals are cost neutral as they are product stewardship programs. We have a very small appropriation, ongoing costs associated with maintenance and software licenses and whatnot associated with the already purchased equipment. These costs do increase over time, particularly because while we have absorbed these in the past, the legislature has asked us to do more monitoring at different sites. And so as we add more monitors, we can no longer absorb the cost. Once you get to $50,000 or so, that's getting up to around a third of a person, of an FTE. So it becomes a significant cost. And then finally, this is a proposal that will actually result in a return to the remediation fund. Largely, the major fiscal item here is a closing of a loophole around saddle tanks. They're for, in particular, large trucks that are transporting either petroleum or hazardous substances. The petroleum that's in the tanker, in the large tanker, is covered clearly by our statutes, but now, especially trucks that are meant to go a long distance, have large saddle tanks that also hold petroleum, and if those are punctured, those are not necessarily, it's a little bit more vague if those are covered clearly by our emergency response statute. So looking to close some of those inconsistencies in the statute and a couple other, while we're at it, much more technical items like changing, you know, procedures to drills and smaller technical items. So these are the three items in the governor's budget for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency.
Thank you for the presentation. And with that, we are out of time. Thank you for everyone attending today. And with that, we are adjourned.